This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Anything? You got any goofs?
I mean, this is the first time we're recording a podcast while I am on baby duty. I am on call right now. Henry has my beeper. And if he's got anything that he's worried about, I'm the one who has to go deal with it. But I mean, he is asleep. It's not like I didn't leave him like down in the basement in the baby cage just crying. But this is the first time that I put him down for bed and then went to go do something else with another human being.
Wow. Okay. Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
Shh. My name is Andrew.
Don't wake Andrew's baby.
Don't wake the baby Henry. I have the baby monitor on. It's fine.
Okay. And
that's what I mean when I say the beeper.
Sure. He does not have to go to a payphone and call you.
No, because he's a baby. Don't be an idiot.
I love talking to my friend every week about books, and that's what we do here on this show, where one of us reads a book and tells the other person about it, and you, the listener, get to reap the benefits. Such as they are.
Craig, what did you read this week?
I read Oliver Twist by a little guy named Charles Dickens.
Yeah, I think this guy's going to go far.
I don't know.
He's going to be big.
If you've ever heard of him, we did an episode about...
I was looking because I figured surely we've done multiple Charles Dickens books at this point. But no, we did a Christmas Carol back in December of 2013, which I think is our very first
Christmas episode. Yeah, someone on one of our social feeds, facebook.com/OverduePod or twitter.com/OverduePod, said, like, what up, do some Dickens maybe? And I honestly was like, I think the only one's the Christmas one with the Christmas ghosts. So when I was looking at our September schedule and making sure that we had some heavy hitters to bring you back into the scene, as it were, from your wandering with Henry, I figured, why not Oliver Twist? He's a boy. You had a boy. Let's go. That was my twist. Whole rationale. That's the twist.
I hear this book has one of the great twist endings in literature.
Where did you hear that? That's interesting.
I heard it because it's Oliver Twist.
Because I might argue... Because the book's
name is Oliver Twist and it has an ending. So it's like...
There is a twist.
There's a twist ending?
But I would say that I had great expectations for this twist. Let's say there was a tale of...
Nope.
Okay. I have never read this book before. I'm not super well versed in Dickens, though I think I read Great Expectations once. Word to your mother and anyone else who's listening, I read an edition that was edited by Mr. Philip Horn. And I specifically want to call that out because he like worked specifically with a version of the text that Dickens had edited as part of some sort of literary magazine whose name escapes me.
Bentley's. Is it the one it was originally published in, or was it something else?
That's a great question.
Because we can talk a little bit about the publication. First, I wanted to say, if I had been more on the ball when you're struggling for those Dickens word plays earlier, I would have said you'd have to be David Copperfield to magic this joke into something funny.
Okay, that's good. I like that. Yes,
I love my favorite jokes are the ones where just like you gotta wait a while and then go back into the well and just explore it some more.
I appreciate how often what you bring to this show is, hey, 2 minutes ago when you could have made a better joke, here's what you should have said.
I took it to the writers and we bounced it around a little bit, and here's what we came up with. I hope you like it.
I really appreciate that.
Oliver Twist was published in a serialized format between 1837 and 1839. Dickens published quite a few books in this format, which is what gave rise to that popular urban myth that he wrote really long because he was paid by the word, which is... I know Dickens enthusiasts get really mad about this. I also think that the truth of it is kind of a distinction without a difference. He was usually paid to write a story that was 20 parts long, and each part was supposed to be 32 pages long.
I ask.
So it's not that he was said, here you get 50 cents a word, write as many words as you want. It was more like, it was more akin to how you might order 22 episodes of an hour-long television show,
and then you got to
make that work, regardless of whether they had story to do that or not.
I asked friend of the show, Dr. Catherine Van Arendonk, wrote about Dickens a lot in her dissertation.
nerd. What a nerd. What a stupid nerd.
She gave me a bunch of material that all got cut from her dissertation, so I may use that later too. I said, if I were to say, man, this book's long, it's almost like Dickens got paid by the word, what would the doctor say? And she said...
And so she had an aneurysm, and then she told you
what? She said, it might be slightly more accurate to say that he was rewarded for length, because he had to fill a certain number of column inches for each installment.
Yeah, and right.
Installments, you know, more times you get paid. But he was not the most egregious, long-winded serial writer of his age. His novels tended to be about the same number of installments, and installments tend to be about the same length each, but his length has much more to do with who he was as a writer than with the economics of his writing circumstances. My man never met an adjective he did not love. My man never met a building he didn't think it worthwhile to describe in painstaking detail.
Was he Robert Jordan? Jeez. Gee whiz. Was he Wheel of Time author Robert Jordan?
This was his second novel. This was the second novel that Charles John Huffham Dickens, born 1812, wrote.
Huffham?
Huffham. Huffham, right. Huffham if you got him. Mm-hmm. And he was the second of eight kids growing up mostly in London. And the like big formative event that's part of his biography is that when he was 12, his father was tossed in debtor's prison. Chuck had to get to work and kind of learned about being poor in London and the politics of the workhouse and whatnot. And he went from a career as a journalist into writing stories like this and writing them serially. Yeah.
So we are not, I don't think, anybody's first introduction to Charles Dickens or Oliver Twist. So I don't think we need to go into full detail on a lot of stuff, which is a thing that I'm saying to kind of mask my own ignorance. But if you want to know more about the context in which Dickens is writing, I mean, the three big things are the Reform Act. I think the 1932 one.
1932?
Or 1832, yes.
Sure, yes.
And the poor laws, which were kind of a welfare reform written around the idea that if you offered people things for free, they would just exploit that system endlessly. And so we have to make earning welfare just an absolute terrible slog.
Yeah.
So that's fun. And then just the Industrial Revolution in general. Like, a lot of his stuff is written... It's dealing with the conditions in the cities that like sprung up as a result of this revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And then also of the laws that came into being as a result of the revolution.
Correct.
So yeah, his works are cited as early examples of the social novel. Like there are definitely ones that exist earlier, like even in the 18th century, but at least in Britain and in like the white literary canon.
Yeah,
this stuff comes up mostly as a commentary on Industrial Revolution stuff.
Yes, yes, and with kind of the
and just the reordering of society that happened around that. So,
sure.
Yeah.
And to shove my glasses all the way up to my nose until I break the bridge of my nose,
until you shove them into your brain.
there's also a revolution in what a novel is happening, and that he is like. he's literally like creating what novels are at this time. Like, he's experimenting with the form. There's a passage I'll read a little bit later where he's talking about how to, like, literally he takes a break in the novel to tell you why he is writing the next scene that he's going to write. And it feels like a thing that you shouldn't encounter before, like, the modernist writers in the early 20th century. But it also feels very of a piece with, like, well, I'm a guy who writes essays and also performs my own stories, so I'm just going to, like, tell you what I'm doing right now.
Sure.
And there's
real quickly just check your audio track and make sure that your mic's not picking up the sound of your hacky sack bouncing around.
You weren't supposed to hear that.
Yeah.
Can you hear the doobie burning in the background, too?
Yeah. It's really loud smoke.
When did he die? He died in 1869. Nice. Well, no, he had a stroke
in 1869, nice.
And then he passed away in 1870. He did get buried in Poets' Corner of Westminster, which we've talked
about.
Where
all the cool poets are buried.
Well, we've talked about a bunch of people who've gotten excluded, including plenty of women, unfortunately. And that's, like, most of it. We talked a little bit about, right, this was published in 37 through 39, his second novel. George Cruikshank did etchings for each installment, most of which a rendition.
Etchings?
A drawing of some kind is included with most of the installments in this book, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I don't know. Anything else that we need to hit before we get into the book?
I think that lays the groundwork. I mean, the most important thing for Oliver Twist in particular is just, like, keep in mind, I guess, what inner city industrial life would have been like for the impoverished. I don't think that this is meant to be an exact snapshot. Like, there are definitely areas that are going to be, like, expanded to make his point, like, that are going to be more satirical. And we're going to talk also about some racist stuff.
Yeah.
That happens.
It's not, by no means a perfect book. It is a lumpy book in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I think you want to keep the historical context in mind, and you want to keep in mind the fact that while he probably planned this all out from a plotting perspective, he likely did not, like, write it all ahead of time. So just as he is, like, very aware of the reader in a way that novels that are like, hey, I wrote my manuscript and sent it to my publisher. Like,
yeah,
it's
no,
different.
Like, this was serialized, and stuff changes over time, you know, but I am willing to bet that the one thing that has not changed is that a writer is not going to write anything that they are not strictly on deadline for.
That's a good point.
Like, I don't, maybe he has an outline or something, but I bet this guy is not writing a bunch of parts of this book that he does not need to turn in the next day.
That's very true. Well, let's take a quick break, Andrew, and then we can learn about this book. I can tell you about it.
Sounds great. Craig, has this ever happened to you? Have you not had a book podcast and you didn't know what to read because your list of books that you had to read was not, like, months long and dictated by other people long in advance?
It's true. I used to live my life that way. And when you took your paternity leave, I sort of led my life that way. I didn't know what to read. Help.
Well, we want to tell you about our sponsor this week, and that is the fine folks over at the Brindle Book Club. It's a new service that's just getting started, and they want to help people figure out what to read next. Brindle Book Club is a literary subscription service that puts together collections of paperback novels from the past and present, organized around shared themes. Right now, if you go to brindlebookclub.com, and that's Brindle, they've got 5 subscription lines that you can choose from for $22 a month, and they are all based around themes. One is based around decorated books. They are books that have won awards that they think are worth the hype. There's a line called I Said, that it's all books from the first person perspective. There is a subscription just called Sick.
Yeah, it's stories of disease and injury and addiction, and it says it's good for readers who also exist as bodies in the world.
Yeah, so these are, they pick from, they say, a healthy mix of contemporary titles, historical gems, and more out there works. And yeah, it's a service that's just going to decide what you need to read, and they're going to send it to you, and it sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, kind of like our show, except you get the actual book.
And you don't have to listen to two idiots talk to each other for an hour before you really get the gist of it.
This sounds like a great idea, Andrew. How can I sign up for Brindle Book Club?
If you go to brindlebookclub.com, that's B-R-I-N-D-L-E bookclub.com, and use the offer code OVERDUE, you can receive $5 off your first month. So again, that's normally $22 a month. You can save $5 off of that. That price does include tax and shipping, so there are no fees that they're going to spring on you that you need to watch out for. B-R-I-N-D-L-E, brindlebookclub.com. Use the offer code OVERDUE. You'll receive $5 off your first month, and you're going to get some cool books. So go check it out.
Sick.
Craig, tell me about the novel Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens.
Oh, sure. I will tell you about the novel. The very serious novel by Mr. Dickens. It's about a poor little good boy named Oliver.
Okay.
And his mom died in childbirth. His dad's just gonzo. Who knows where he is? Not gonzo. He's gonzo.
I think if there were a Muppet adaptation of Oliver Twist where Gonzo was the dad, I would be confused, but I would watch it.
Well, you wouldn't. Then there'd be no Gonzo in the movie, which would be sad.
Muppet Christmas Carol is
good,
and so I'm up for more Muppet Dickens adaptations. Is what I'm saying.
I'm up for more Muppet adaptations in general. Mm-hmm. So Oliver has got no family. He's got no nothing, and so he is for a few years early in his life. So this book is quote unquote a biography of this boy named Oliver Twist. It is, as we said before the break, it is also a like social novel about poverty in London. And the main way that we get that is through depictions of like the underlife. And by that, I mean criminals who steal stuff.
Of course. Yeah.
So
right.
It is not as it's about Oliver Twist. But we spend a lot of time with people who aren't Oliver Twist, especially.
It sounds like it's as much about Oliver Twist as it is about like just the events and the settings that are happening around Oliver Twist.
Yes, and part of that is because he's a child, so this is not a like Dark is Rising or Harry Potter-esque. Like Oliver's not going to change the world. There's no prophecy that he's a special boy.
Nobody shows up to the orphanage and like breaks the door down and tells Oliver that he's a wizard.
No, that is, wizards weren't invented yet. And so he is just like got to live his life for a few years at the mercy, and actually for the whole book, at the mercy of other people. And one of the biggest takeaways for me of this book is that I really couldn't tell you much about Oliver at all, as a person. He is a good little boy who just doesn't want to do bad, and that serves him throughout the rest of the book. He's kind of a cipher in that way.
Do we know much of his parentage? Like we know the dad's not around. We know his mom died in childbirth, but like,
well,
is
Andrew,
he like who does he? Why does he end up in poverty? Why does he have no other relatives around him? Like, what's his background?
Well, because we don't know, like, who his people are, he just becomes an orphan. And so there's no record of who he belongs to or where he should go. His parentage becomes part of the titular twist a little bit later.
Yeah.
But for a good portion of the book, we have literally no idea where he came from. And so he goes, according to the poor laws and whatever, he just gets like first shoved into a house run by this woman named Mrs. Mann, who like keeps most of her like stipend for herself. This is a trope that you see in other fiction where people are like taking advantage of foster care systems or other sort of like child care systems where they are skimming stuff off the top and only giving the kids as much as they need to survive and then like keeping money for themselves, which again is like an indictment of the systemic poverty of the time that this woman would do that thing. Thanks, Charles Dickens. So this is also when he's like not getting enough to eat and stuff as a little kid. It helps to stunt his growth. So he's always this like little sad boy all the time.
Right. Because that this if you know anything about this book and you've never read the book and you've never seen the movie, you do know the scene in the movie where the little Oliver Twist in the orphanage goes up to the big fat man.
Yes. Mr. Bumble.
And as I was reading about this book, I'm not trying to do like fat shaming or whatever. I'm saying that Dickens, for whatever reason, seems to create a contrast between the poor characters and the rich characters by making all the rich characters overweight.
Well, and not even necessarily the rich characters. It is like good versus bad characters. Like,
sure,
this is written in an era where you describe like people's physical appearances tell you a lot about the type of person they are.
Yeah.
And this is a theme that we will revisit a lot, which sometimes he does to great effect and it's really nice. And then sometimes it's really mean.
Yeah. So Oliver goes to the big man in the movie and he says, "Please, sir, may I have some more?" And the big man goes, "More?"
Yeah, that's basically it. On his 9th birthday, he gets sentenced to the workhouse, who is run by Mr. Bumble, who's the guy who says more, I think. and there are, or maybe it's the guy who works in the cafeteria. It doesn't matter. It's basically Mr. Bumble. And the other boys put him up to this stunt because they're like, well, we don't want to get in trouble for asking for more food, so we're going to make Oliver do it because he sucks and he's little. And he says,
and if they decide that they're just going to give us more, then everybody wins.
Yes, exactly. The actual line, this is like one of those like, you know, trivia questions.
Like it's, he never says, "Beam me up, Scotty," or whatever.
Yeah, he says, "Please, sir, I want some more." So keep that and just like put that in the back of your brain. If you take nothing else from
this
podcast.
Is this going to be on the test? Why are you telling me to remember?
Not you. I'm giving it to our listeners in case it's like, oh, well, he doesn't say, "Can I have some," whatever. "Please, sir, want some more.
Please, sir, Mike, I got some more."
And there is just outright chaos. Everyone is so offended that this little boy wants more food that the board of the workhouse puts up a five pound reward for whoever will take this kid off their hands.
You would think that it would cost a lot less than that too if just
you
given
would
him more food.
You would think that. That's true. After he talks his way out of getting apprenticed to a chimney sweep, he is apprenticed to an undertaker named Mr. Sourberry. Let me describe Mr. Sourberry to you to give
his name implies that he's a really great guy.
He is actually a good guy.
Oh.
Maybe it's a British pronunciation. Maybe it's Mr. Sourberry. Mr. Sourberry was a tall, gaunt, large jointed man attired in a suit of threadbare black with darned cotton stockings of the same color and shoes to answer. His features were not naturally intended to wear a smiling aspect, but he was in general rather given to professional jocosity. His step was elastic and his face betokened inward pleasantry as he advanced to Mr. Bumble and shook him cordially by the hand.
Yeah, this guy totally. Why would anybody think he had been paid by the word? It's just this is tight.
Yeah, you know? It's real.
That's the minimum number of words you could have used to get that across.
All things considered, though, it's a really good character sketch.
Yeah,
but it is not concise of a character sketch. Mr. Sourberry brings Oliver on to like be around when people die because like he's a little kid and he'll comfort them, I guess, because he's an undertaker. Sourberry is. And two other apprentices are really mean to Oliver. This kid, Noah, insults Oliver's dead mom. And Oliver, like, goes ham on him and beats the crap out of him, which then Sourberry's mean wife gets Oliver in trouble. And for fear of being in worse trouble, Oliver runs away. And this is, you know, several chapters of the book. Oliver's like, I gotta get out of here. And we get to dirty old London. Now, Andrew, have you ever heard of a kid named the Artful Dodger? Is that a name?
I've heard that name, yeah.
Yeah, his name is Jack Dawkins. He's a bit of a hotshot. And when I say kid, I don't know how old any of the kids in this book are. When, like, Dickens will say kid, and I think he means, like, 17-year-old in, like, a kid's
days. Are we talking,
like,
how, like, 39-year-old men can do dumb stuff and,
yes,
you know, boys will be boys defense? It's like that. Is that the kind of kid we're talking about?
It's maybe, but it's also, like, when you were 17 in the 1800s, people still called you mister. And I don't know who is... I just don't know. Most people are either really old, and you and Oliver talks about it, or they might as well be 20. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
So he meets the Artful Dodger and his sidekick, Charlie Bates, and the Artful Dodger is like, hey, let's be friends. Why don't you come with me to this dude's house where we all live? It's totally above board. And he's not going to ask you to do anything. You can just live there. He asks us to do some work, but, like, it's fine. And, well, wouldn't you know, Andrew, they're a bunch of criminals, and they steal stuff all the time. But Oliver doesn't get it. Oliver...
He's not a crime boy?
Well, he doesn't... He kind of doesn't understand, like, he goes to bed, and he has met, Fagin. He has met Mr. Fagin. So we're going to talk about Fagin in a second, because it's a big... part of this book, at like impact of this character is a big deal. But we meet Fagin. Oliver goes to sleep. He wakes up. He sees Fagin, who's running this crime lab, like pull a watch.
Not like a Law and Order.
No,
like
sorry.
Forensic crime lab. He's running a lab where they invent new kinds of crime.
Yes.
Because it's a time of great innovation.
it's the crime revolution. He pulls a pocket watch or something out of the floorboards and like gawks at it, and Oliver catches him, and Fagin's like, well, this is just a watch I made. It's my retirement fund to sell it later. And Dawkins and his buddy come back, and he's like, hey, did you make a bunch of purses today? And they're like, yeah. And Oliver doesn't understand how these young boys were able to make a bunch of handkerchiefs and purses while they were watching an execution. Because he doesn't understand the double meaning of the word make, as in steal from people who were watching the execution. Because he's just a little boy who would never steal anything. So he doesn't assume that that's what they're talking about. Right. And this, obviously, the world comes crashing down when Oliver gets enlisted to go pickpocketing with them, realizes what they do, and takes the fall for them later.
I'm so confused about how the shadowy cabal of young men could be involved in crime.
Let's talk about Fagin real quick, because I'm sure you pulled
up
a little
bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he is a Jewish character, and he is widely understood to be a grade A textbook example of what anti-Semitism looks like.
Yep.
There are a few components to this. One, obviously, he is the leader of a gang of boy thieves. That's fun. Two, imagery of him throughout the book is often like explicitly devilish or satanic.
Yes, correct.
Which is fun. And three, Dickens. Now, this is a thing we can talk about a little bit, but Dickens throughout most of the book often refers to Fagin as the Jew.
Yes.
When he is not like the white guy, the race.
Yep. Yep.
with other characters, like it is called out as like a part of his character way more often than happens for anybody else in the book.
Correct. No one else gets that sort of treatment. And I was honestly like in a good way struck by ways in which Dickens will sometimes not refer to a character's name, but like later after someone has committed murder, you know who he's talking about, and he says like something like "said the murderer," and
so they get epithets.
Well, and it reflects how people are being perceived in that scene, and so when you think about it that way, there's an element to which everyone in every scene that Fagin's in is thinking about him as the Jew, and it just doesn't help that Dickens doesn't temper it in any other way, especially to a modern reader and also not to readers of the time who also didn't like it.
Well, and so Dickens was, I'm honestly not sure how to read some of the stuff around what he had to say about faking.
Yeah.
He says it unfortunately was true of the time to which the story refers that class of criminal almost invariably was a Jew. So that's kind of a all stereotypes have some truth to them,
yep,
sort of defense.
Yep.
But he, of course, protested and said, you know, I've got nothing but good things to say about Jewish people, and I work with them all the time, and it's totally fine and great. The more, I think, the slightly more good faith thing that Dickens apparently did is that, you know, so like we said, the story was published in serialized format. And so in later entries, this thing where Fagin is referred to as the Jew, like, sort of fades away. Dickens apparently held up publication of some edition of this book to eradicate those mentions in response to criticism that
he
got.
He also, because he used to perform a lot of his text, especially later in his career. And apparently he stopped doing offensive voices for Fagin because he's such a good guy, Mr. Dickens.
No, I'm definitely not saying that Dickens is
totally
exonerated in this. There are things that he said that appear to be in good faith.
Yes.
Yes.
Correct.
Even if they don't necessarily. It's not necessarily great that he was doing this kind of thing in the first place.
No, and to a reader, to me reading it in 2019, I am struck by the fact that there's no balance to what is clearly overt anti-Semitic villainy descriptions, right?
Right, because I feel like there's a way that literature and other art can do this where...
Yeah.
Characters are portrayed this way, but you as an audience member, on another layer operating above the narrative, understand how you are supposed to be responding to this mm-hmm. character and thinking about this character.
Yeah, and you can also have multiple types of people. There is not a character who happens to be Jewish who is a good person in this book at all.
You're kind of saying that people need to, if they're going to include a goofus, they need to have a Gallant.
It's not the only answer, but in a book with 200 characters in it, maybe.
That you couldn't have one,
just
chill dude who happened to be Jewish.
Yes.
It's kind of a shortcoming. Okay, that's fair.
And it speaks to the impact of this book, which I think is why it's worth calling out, that apparently there may have been a guy that this character was based on named Ikey Solomon, who did run like a bunch of kids doing crime and was called a kidsman, which is the noun for people who do this, who train kids as pickpockets.
And that's where Nicole Kidman gets her family name.
That's
from.
True, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then the popularity of the novel caused Fagin to replace Kidsman as a term in some circles. So that's the impact of this book that sold very well. And unfortunately, you've got this bad depiction of a Jewish character. Okay. But Fagin does suck. He is a bad dude.
Sure. I think we have laid the groundwork for Fagin. Now we can just talk about who the character
yes.
is, I guess.
So Fagin has set Oliver off with these boys, and the boys pickpocket this guy named Mr. Brownlow while he's reading a book at a book stand. Oliver unfortunately gets caught, even though he didn't do anything wrong. And after a protracted court battle where Brownlow decides not to press any charges, Oliver faints, and Brownlow takes him home. That's just how the world works, I guess. This orphan maybe robbed you. You say he didn't, and then you just get to take him home with
you. But then you realize that he has a heart of gold.
Yes. So then he hangs out with Brownlow for a little while. There's a bit pursuant to your earlier question. That's a word I made up. I was looking for pursuant. To your point about his parentage, Andrew, he's hanging in Mr. Brownlow's house. There's a painting he gets very interested in, and a bunch of people are like, wow, Oliver, you look like that painting. And Brownlow just is like, shh, don't talk about it. We're just going to move on now. Oliver, can you return these books for me? Because I, you know, feel bad about the bookseller who got involved. When he does that, this girl Nancy and this guy Bill Sykes, they are an item, even though Bill Sykes is very abusive to her. She was trained by Fagin. And they ambush Oliver and, like, bring him back to Fagin. And so Brownlow is
just
like,
what he thought he was out.
Yes. And this happens a good number. Versions of this happen several times to Oliver throughout the book where, like, a nice old man will start taking care of him. And then some dirty junk people will be like, nah,
but then he gets
we got
drawn
you.
Back into his life of crime.
Yes.
Sure.
Bill Sykes is one of the villains of the novel. He is a bigger villain, I think, even in the musical, because the third villain, Monks, who we meet a little bit later, is actually not in the musical at all. So Sykes becomes like one of the big bads of the musical in a way that he's not even in the book. He's a big, nasty dude. The man who growled out these words was a stoutly built fellow of about 35 in a black velveteen coat, very soiled drab breeches, lace-up half boots, and gray cotton stockings, which enclosed a bulky pair of legs with large swelling calves, the kind of legs which in such costume always look in an unfinished and incomplete state without a set of fetters to garnish them. He had a brown hat on his head and a dirty belcher handkerchief round his neck, with the long frayed ends of which he smeared the beer from his face as he spoke. He disclosed, when he had done so, a broad, heavy countenance with a beard of 3 days' growth and two scowling eyes, one of which recently various particolored symptoms of having been recently damaged by a blow.
This is just so economical.
Yeah.
Like, it's moving too fast almost.
It really is. I can't wait to get to the next chapter. And so the big thing that happens once Sykes is in the picture is that Fagin enlists Oliver in this heist that Sykes is going to rob some people's house, and they need a little boy to get through a window. It's sort of like how they need that guy in Ocean's 11 to squeeze into the fake money box.
Mm-hmm.
They need Oliver to do that here. I like a good heist. There's a couple chapters where they're like casing the joint and planning the heist. I enjoyed that. I'm always into that. The robbery goes bad. Oliver gets heard. A dude accidentally shoots him. Sykes almost saves Oliver, but then leaves him behind. He and his criminal buddy both run away. And then what do you know? The people who accidentally shot Oliver, they wait until he is convalesced, get him to tell his story about being captured by criminal kids. And then they're like, you're great. We're going to keep you. We're just gonna make you healthy, and we're just going to keep you here. Because that's the way the world works.
Yeah, you just find a boy and his finders keepers.
Yes. He winds up living with Miss Rose and her guardian, Mrs. Maley. And this is like, there's a little like pastoral section in the middle of the book where like Oliver gets to go pick flowers and be kind to people. And again,
I'm sure like one of the flowers, like it's criminal, like dressed up as a flower and grabs Oliver and he takes him back to London.
He does have a moment where he looks out the window and he sees, I believe, Fagin and Monks, who, again, we have yet to really meet, like staring at him. And then when he looks back, they're gone. So he's clearly being like traced or hunted or something, because again, Fagin doesn't want Oliver to, like, you know, go to the cops. I don't really understand. But then partially through the book, this dude Monks appears, and it is clear that he has it out for Oliver, and he needs Fagin to, like, really ruin him. And, you know, if we need to kill him, we'll kill him. But
I feel like if you're worried about Oliver going to the cops, like bringing him further into your criminal enterprise, even as he escapes you multiple times, is not maybe like the best.
Yeah, but strategy. The system is really broken. He really got lucky when Brownlow saved him, because the judge was really excited to like lock Oliver away, and
that's the guy he tried to pickpocket, but who realized that he wasn't pickpocketing him. Okay.
And Oliver's actually very sad about what happened with Mr. Brownlow, because Mr. Brownlow, to all he knows, Oliver is a thief and ran away with those books and never came back.
Sure.
And when Oliver finally gets Miss Rose to like take him and go see what's going on, Brownlow has like skipped the country for some reason and he's not around. So Oliver can't
maybe
prove.
He's a criminal.
Maybe. Maybe he's doing sneaky stuff.
We're cracking this thing wide open.
It's true. And so the latter half of the book is Monks, who is now a huge important character in the story. he meets up with Mr. Bumble from the workhouse, who has married Mrs. Corny, who used to work at the workhouse, and they have information on Oliver's mom. They have a locket that used to belong to her.
Of course, this classic like Johnny Tremaine
stuff.
Like there's always a locket or a picture or some just like barely legally admissible piece of evidence.
And they have kept it a secret. Maybe they're going to sell it later. And Monks is like, I'll give you money for it now. And they say, okay. And he throws it in the river.
Okay.
So now Monks confirms that Oliver is who he thinks he is, though we, the reader, don't know why any of this is important. And then Mr. Brownlow shows back up again. Turns out he and Oliver are going to be friends again. And the like the precipitating action for the end of the book is, remember Nancy and Bill Sykes, Andrew?
Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah. Who could forget?
Who could forget? Now, Bill Sykes is a big, bad dude, and he's the one who got Oliver shot and all that kind of stuff. Nancy,
Bill Sykes is a classic, like, 80s movie bully name.
Yeah,
like,
it's
Bill,
really
Bill
good.
Sykes is never a cool dude who you want to know. He's always a guy who's going to shake you down for your lunch money.
Yes, and Nancy is probably the most... to me, was one of the more complicated characters in the book. She has lived this life of crime, which she fell into because of poverty. There's a bunch of passages where Dickens gives, like, lets characters talk about the fact that they're doing these bad things because they don't have other options. So it that's where, like, the social novel aspect kind of creeps in. But Nancy will do the bidding of Fagin and Sykes and, like, capture Oliver, but then she's one of the people who actually get in the way and, like, keep them from actually beating him to death. And so she starts to want to help him. She overhears the fact that Monks and Fagin know who Oliver is and that they want to get him and do sorts of stuff. So Nancy tries to sneak out, form an alliance with Oliver's crew. Keep in mind, Oliver knows none of this. There's a whole bunch of adults who are trying to improve Oliver's life and find out who his parents were and stuff, and he doesn't know it all. It's real.
Oliver seems pretty clueless, to be totally honest with you.
Yeah, and this is a long tract of the book where Oliver is like maybe on every 10th page. Like, he's just, his name's on the cover, if you know. Other people are doing stuff. And Nancy's arc kind of culminates in enlisting Oliver's party to help out. She gets found out by Fagin and Bill Sykes. Bill Sykes thinks that she ratted him out to people. And in, like, a murderous rage, he murders her. And...
that's the kind of thing you do in a murderous rage.
Yeah.
It'd be a shame to waste a murderous rage on, like, petty theft or something.
And he does, like, he did love her in a way, so he feels very guilty. And he ultimately ends up dying himself in this really, like, elaborate town mob who is... no murder occurs in this book until this moment. So up until this point, everyone's been a pickpocket. So he really crossed the line, Bill Sykes did.
Just really stepping things up.
And he gets town mobbed up on top of a roof and, like, falls to his death. And then the Oliver party manages to, like, find Monks, arrest him, sort of, like, citizen's arrest. There's a whole big info dump on who Oliver's family is. That honestly, like, I don't know if I even want to tell you because it doesn't, to me, improve the novel at all to tell you. It's
So we can talk about this a little bit. But so Dickens has, like, this book has a reputation as a social novel. Dickens has this reputation as a writer who, like, brought a lot of attention to the plight of the impoverished, especially the urban poor. But in this book, he also muddies the waters a little bit. Like, Oliver is virtuous and he is incorruptible, but it turns out to be because he is like innately good because he is a like,
yes,
he's a member of the upper class and he just didn't know about it.
Yes.
But all the other characters, like the characters who are in Oliver's position and sort of share his plight, seem like, I mean, I think Nancy is maybe a little bit of an outlier, but otherwise it seems like, yeah, only the like evil and the stupid and the petty like end up in this level of society anyway.
It's really rough.
So like, why are we supposed to care about it? I mean, it may well be that Dickens didn't fully intend for this thing to be like a parable about the plight of the working poor or whatever.
Yeah, but I've got a couple thoughts on that. There's in the like Animal House montage of the end of this book where, you know,
Oliver went to law school.
Like Oliver gets adopted, we find out who, because Miss Rose also has a secret parentage, and her betrothed Harry actually gives up his political ambitions to become a parson and marry her. So like there's a little bit of class consciousness going on there. Bates Bailey, the Artful Dodger's friend Charles,
Charlie Bates,
yes, he becomes like a good guy. Like the stuff when he learns about Sykes committing murder, he's like, I'm out of here, I'm gonna go be a good kid.
I knew we was doing crimes, yes, but this is too much.
The Artful Dodger, who has the coolest name of the book, he gets arrested like 2/3 of the way through. We never see him again. That kid stinks.
Not so artful at dodging.
No,
not as artful at dodging as I was led to believe.
No, and there's like another kid early on, a friend of Oliver's, little Dick, who is just a little sad boy who does end up passing away. He didn't do anything to anybody, but he just dies because of, you know, his circumstances. So there's some plight of the poor in that, and there's some amount of change for these characters, but like there's enough like just evil people, just melodramatic evil people, that I do think complicate the social novel aspect of it.
Maybe they're evil because, like you said, like there is nothing else for them. Maybe that is the life, yeah, that they've just been pushed into. But then by having Oliver be this incorruptible paragon,
correct?
I don't know. Just it makes it feel less straightforward than it could.
Yes. And so when I was talking to Dr. Van Arendonk about this, she was citing.
I'm not going to be able to live with her. I need to record a podcast with her.
She was kind of citing this tension of the book because Dickens almost refers to it as a biography. He does refer to it as a biography of Oliver multiple times, but like it ends with him still being a kid and getting adopted, and then like he doesn't write anything else. Maybe he died. Maybe. But
right,
it doesn't.
After the end.
It is not a story where Oliver grows and changes. It is not a coming of
age. And
he
grows up to have like a super cool workhouse for kids where all the cool orphans end up at.
Yeah, some bad people get their comeuppance, and sure, like that's good. Like the Bumbles end up, you know, running out of money or whatever, and they have to work in the workhouse. You know, look how the mighty have fallen, Mr. Bumble. Can you have some more?
Bumbles bounce, though, is what how I understand. That's one thing I know about Bumbles.
They don't fall down. Oliver as a character doesn't have an arc of change, and most of the other characters don't. Not big ones where you like watch them grow and learn and things like that. I do want to shout out this one section from the birth of the novel, the storytelling revolution that I talked about earlier.
Of course.
Chapter the 17th of book the first. This is after Oliver has been kidnapped and beaten up a bit by Fagin's gang. And then we just get this like long diatribe from the author directly. It is the custom on the stage in all good murderous melodramas to present the tragic and the comic scenes in as regular alternation as the layers of red and white in a side of streaky, well-cured bacon. And then he like goes on to give you a couple like examples of what that means. And he says, but I have said it in this place because I'm anxious to disclaim at once the slightest desire to tantalize my readers by leaving young Oliver Twist in situations of doubt and difficulty and then flying off at a tangent to impertinent matters which have nothing to do with him.
Just really leaving him twisting in the wind.
Yes. And so he know, like he is upfront with the reader in this serialized story that he needs to balance different tonal sensibilities, that he is aware that by depriving you of access to Oliver's fate, he is like making that more interesting later. And so following this bacon speech, we get the scene where Mr. Bumble like courts Mrs. whatever her face is before she's Mrs. Bumble. And they're just kind of like goofy and he's like a gross guy. And you get a little bit of snippets of plot, like, you know, things that are going to come up later in the plot, but it's mostly just a comic scene of him courting her. And then you get back to the thief stuff later. And it's just this interesting, like, oh, you are inventing a style of book that you're going to write 15 more of later. And it was weird to me. I did not know that about this book. That was a thing I didn't know going in.
You didn't know it was laying so much like groundwork for other stuff?
Well, I didn't know that Dickens was going to be talking to me as directly as he was about the nature of novels and storytelling.
Got it. Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I can definitely see why Dr. Van Aerdonk
would want to talk
so
about that.
Would have so much to say about this.
And the last, this will be my final thing, and then you can ask me any other silly questions if you have any.
Why would you assume that I only have silly questions? That's insulting.
No, it's I want silly questions because you got to have
that's
the tragic
just how you, that's
and
how
the comic.
You, how you think about me?
Like a okay. like a slice of well cured bacon.
Am
Andrew.
I a clown? Do I amuse you?
whenever these people take Oliver in, these people of means. Miss Rose, Mrs. Maley, Mr. Brownlow, etc.
You got people who are mean and then people who have means.
Correct. And
makes you think.
They really, I don't want to say enjoy, but I guess they find, you know, virtue and value in like, here is a boy who needs our help. The system has failed him. This poor orphan lad who's just so charming and wonderful. And they take him in and they comment on like it's a good if I could just save one boy that would be great, and like y'all have these giant houses in London. It just I get it's a little
the ending of that sentence is if I could just save one boy I would feel better and I wouldn't have to put out that many resources.
Correct. Yes. And I wouldn't have to help boys who need like who have lost their way, right? That's the back to what we were saying before of like the kids who are just kind of bad kids or bad people, Bill Sykes and Fagin or whatever it is.
Right. I just want to find kids who are innately good who just happen to be impoverished.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And have a mysterious identity that will honestly tell all of us later that all of this work was worth it because he's one of us. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that kind of undercuts the novel, but it is very funny, and Dickens's character sketches are usually good when they're not, you know, steeped in 19th century
anti-Semitism. Yeah, sure, there you go.
There's lots of good goofs and pokes at human behavior, so like it's a fun read, and I honestly like I didn't really know how it was gonna wrap up until like once I was like, oh, the only thing left to do is do the mystery part and we're just going to find out why he's related to people and why that matters.
Did you like feel the length of it? Sometimes with a book this long, I feel like the length can smother you a little bit, or it's just like, or if you're not paying close enough attention, it can kind of become noise that you realize that you're not actually getting any meaning out of. Do you know what I mean?
I honestly,
like, when something is too
wordy.
Yeah,
no, I do. I was honestly surprised that that didn't hit me because, okay. I wonder if that is to its advantage as a serial story. Hey, any of our listeners who want a cool reading project, read this like two chapters at a time, like two chapters a month for the next 2 or 3 years, and then like write me a letter telling me how it went. Like, live your life as if you were in 1837 and like see how it goes. Cause I feel like he does have a good sense of what the audience wants to know next. And oddly is pretty good at placing when the action should happen in the macro scale of it too. Again, it's just the fact that like, he backed himself into a corner where he had to write a mystery novel at the end. And I don't know that he meant to when he started, or at least he meant to do some other things too. That's the twist.
Okay.
Any silly questions?
No, No, I don't have any silly questions. I'm not going to perform for you.
Okay.
Jeez.
Who am I? Charles Dickens? if you, the listener, have any questions for us, you can send them in to overduepod@gmail.com. Hit us up on facebook.com or twitter.com. Let me say that again. Time code me. Hit us up on facebook.com or twitter.com/overduepod, and you can join us in the social media sphere. I want to thank a bunch of folks who have done that recently, including Jada, Patrick, Sophie, Christine, Casey, Blaze, John, Naya, Erica, Stephen, Aaron, Blair, and a lot more. Andrew, if folks want to know more about the show, where should they go?
They should go to overduepodcast.com, which is our internet website. Up there we have links to Apple Podcasts, it's Google Play, and our RSS feed. Subscribe using any of those, or Stitcher, or Spotify, or any of the places where podcasts are available. I think there are a lot of sources these days. So I think this podcasting thing's going to take off.
I heard people are getting into it, and now it's going to be a thing.
I've read all kinds of articles about how it is and isn't a thing lately.
I think Conan O'Brien started podcasting.
He did invent podcasting based on an earlier proto podcast by Sarah Koenig. Anyway, enough funny goofs. To get more serious, go to our website, overduepodcast.com. We've got all that stuff. We got a link to our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/overduepod. You can give us some money, support us in buying books and other equipment. While I was out on paternity leave, we upgraded Craig's computer.
Woo-woo.
We got me a new mixer.
Yeah.
We're just doing all kinds of stuff.
Andrew,
just
guess
making
what?
The show better.
Guess what starts next week?
The rest of our lives.
Spooktober.
Oh yeah, right. Our spooky October celebration of ghosts and goblins and ghouls and guys.
Yep. Real quick, I'll tell you, we're reading From Hell, The Ghost Bride, Pen Pal, Psycho, and A Nightmare Before Christmas. You can go to our website to find out more information, but it should be a fun month.
A fun and scary month.
Yep.
Spooky. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. I feel like we're getting back into the swing of things. Henry's still asleep. We've
in
had
his
to do
swing.
No edits.
Yeah.
Yeah, in his swing, and we've had to do no edits where I've had to get up and rescue him. So that's good to know. Just every scrap of normalcy I can claw back is a victory
at
this point. Okay, everybody, thank you so much for listening. And until we talk to you next week, try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum podcast.
So we talked about Chucky, which is how his friends.
Whoa.
No, we can start again if you want.
Oh, man. Do you have another one of those in the chamber? You want to go again?